for a minute or two so I can get my head around what we're trying to do?
Yeah, no.
No.
No, we do soft opens. Okay, so, like, all right. We just start recording.
So what happens? Do you just, like, just put it out there on the internet? And
Yeah. No, that's kind of how it works. You just record you saying stupid things. And then you put it somewhere on the internet.
Have I said something stupid enough yet?
That'll be up to the listeners.
Wait, did we start it?
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. We're recording?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Awesome. Cool.
Yeah. No. Okay.
I'm pretty sure every podcast I've listened to so far starts with one of y'all saying something along the lines of, are we recording now?
Oh, is it on? Yeah.
That's a tradition that we picked up from the Nerdist.
Yeah.
Because I feel like every time there's a guest on the Nerdist, we're like, oh, no, we're recording right now.
Nerdist is another podcast?
Yes.
Yeah, very, very famous podcast, actually. Yeah.
Okay.
Just waiting for somebody to say something insensitive about the Jews.
Yeah, that's
one good time when we do this. I'm just like, oh God.
No, that I remember that happening on a very.
You know, if it's less than 40 ounce, then it's concentrate.
Oh God, that's good.
We need to do that again. People are asking
for
it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Chris, take it away.
Oh, you're listening to Name Redacted Podcast.
I feel like we're doing NPR because we both have warm cups of coffee.
Oh, it's so great.
Yeah.
I wish I had a real microphone. I could get that nice proximity effect.
Yeah.
I was like, you're listening.
Yeah.
Name Redacted Podcast.
Where you, like, you almost need the pop filter, but no one here sputters enough for
it. Yeah. Yeah, get that Luther Vandross voice going.
Nice.
We have an amazing guest this week. Alex, you want to introduce our guest?
Yeah, as usual, I'm Alexander Fulmer.
I'm Chris Nielsen.
I'm Colin Norris.
And we actually have our new producer on.
Producer Pro Tem.
Producer Pro Tem. She's going to see how she likes it, and if she hates it, then we're going to be on the search again for like the fifth time. Do you want to introduce yourself?
My name's Olivia Taylor. We're going to see how this works out. It seems like it'll be fun.
And for the record, it's not my Olivia. It's a different Olivia.
Yeah, not Colin's
just
fiance.
Just swimming in Olivias.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because
they're everywhere.
Like, there's Olivia this one, there's Olivia mine, there's Olivia Lipe, and there's Olivia early.
Yeah.
There's so many Olivias.
Wow, there are a lot of us.
Yeah. Too many. Almost like Alex's.
There are literally dozens of us.
Yeah. So, we have a very awesome guest this week. It's my father, actually.
Yay! You came from his balls.
It's true. Those of you who have been longer listeners, you guys know a little bit about my dad because I talk about him here and there every once in a while.
He's popped in on the microphone in the background a few times.
Alex, your mail's here. what do you want to do for dinner, son?
Back
go away!
Back
my friends are over, Dad.
Back when it used to be on the front porch of his house. Alex, what are you doing out here? Shut up, I'm recording, Dad. But as some of you know, my dad is a professor at a very prestigious university. He teaches anthropology.
We can name drop it.
Yeah, he works at Wake Forest. I got in that weird mode of like I can't name things right now. Like
it would defeat the name of the podcast.
Yeah, whatever. But he's here to actually his focus was cultural anthropology. Still is. But he growing up I actually got a lot of insight into how anthropology and culture and everything works because he's my dad. And it's funny because like I got asked one day like what the things that I'm nerdiest about are, and like in the list of the top five things is anthro. Like I'm super nerdy about anthro, and it's such a weird thing to like throw into that category of like what are the things like oh like comic books and like podcasts and I like artwork and anthropology. Like it's a totally different switch. But he's here today to talk to us about something specific in terms of culture. But I'm going to let him talk to you guys a little bit about what he does and has done.
Let's talk about your credentials, Steve.
Yeah.
My credentials.
Like, this is an interview with someone who matters. Like,
well, I have a PhD in cultural anthropology that I got from a place called Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio. I suppose that's it. Those are my credentials.
done. Haven't done anything since then. Just, I got it when I was in my 20s, and ever since then, I've just sat at a desk at work and just sat there.
Yeah. I think you're our first PhD.
I think you are our first PhD.
I think.
I'm pretty sure.
Not the first person with a master's,
no,
but the
first
one with a PhD.
First doctorate.
Yeah.
First doctor.
Okay.
Dr. Steve.
Dr. Foam.
Dr. Foam.
It was always so weird, like, having, like, when I was younger, having kids come over to the house that knew my dad outside of just knowing him through me, because I had a couple friends that actually went to school at Wake Forest, and one of them, a kid named Adam, used to come over to the house and call him Professor Fulmer, and I was like, dude, it's Steve. Just call him Steve.
Well, I mean, like, when I was a kid, it was always Alex's dad, and
yeah.
Then I got older, and then it was Steve.
Yeah.
And then it was, like, Dad 2.0.
Yeah. It's funny because, like, I've never stood on that, like, pretense of introducing my parents as my mom and dad. It's always been Phyllis and Steve, because they've always introduced themselves to my friends as Phyllis and Steve. Like, you guys get this kind of weird look on your face when any of my friends call you Mr. or Mrs. something, and you're just like, just call me fucking Steve. Like, that's my name.
I don't
name.
Think I'd put it quite that way.
No, not quite. We did a lot of traveling because of my dad's job, which has been really cool. Got to see a lot of different parts of the world, and dad was part of, in a pretty direct way, you were part of some part of the relief effort for the Nepal earthquakes, right?
Well, I was part of small efforts, yes, but I am not really very much a mainstream kind of operators, so I didn't get involved with, with UNICEF or with the Red Cross, but channeled some money that that I helped raise. That was actually mostly raised by students at Wake Forest and some other places to local communities, bypassing all the intermediaries like the big NGOs, because I felt like direct involvement was more beneficial to the folks who got to define their own issues and then got to get all the money instead of some portion of the money.
Well, that's great. That's fantastic. Mm-hmm.
It bypasses the whole FEMA debacle kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which is something...
For as good things that the UNICEF and Direct Relief and Red Cross do, at the end of the day, there's still bureaucracy.
Yeah. Yeah. So, a lot of red tape, a lot of forms you have to sign just so you can not die.
And that's just because you're so big.
Yeah. Yeah. So, how long have you been teaching at Wake now?
Well, I've been at Wake Forest for 23 years in a month, just about a month from right now. And I started teaching in the anthropology department in, I believe it was 1997. It's a little indeterminate because I was at the medical school prior to that. And I started my involvement with the anthropology department by first going to some faculty meetings. And then eventually I worked out teaching a course, and then after that a course or two, and then two or three. Eventually I got hired onto the faculty in the anthropology department. So the transition was gradual in my memory of when the first moment was is a little hazy. Let's say 1997.
So about 19 years.
Yeah, about.
Is that math?
You got it right once.
Yeah,
you got it quicker than I did too. Like that, you know what?
When I'm not rolling dice and having to do that kind of thing in my head, I'm good. I can math, but
yeah, you're clearly a math nerd.
Yeah, you could say I'm numerate.
So what? What we had talked about having my...
I know how to read numbers.
That's essentially what being good with numbers is. There's literate and there's numerate. Eat your fucking chips.
So we wanted to get my dad on today to talk about nerd culture. Because as a lot of you know, it's become more and more prevalent in recent years. It's gone from being very outcasty to seen as pretty cool. And we kind of wanted to just discuss a little bit of like... different things that have to do with nerd culture with him, because having that cultural anthropological insight on it, we all kind of thought would be very interesting. So we kind of wanted to just start it off by asking, like, when you were growing up, like, what was nerd culture like for you?
Okay, so first let me clarify that nerd culture is not something that I have ever studied specifically.
just massive caveat.
So my professional expertise doesn't lie directly there. However, looking back on my own life, I believe that even though I did not think so at the time, I believe I was categorized as a nerd in school. But back then, I don't think you could have said we had nerd culture. Nerds were people who were identified by other people as nerds. Nerds didn't identify themselves as nerds. And so there was no real cohesion behind it. There was no seeking out of another nerd because of their nerdiness, so to speak.
Right.
You might seek other people out because you had similar interests, which later became part of nerd culture. But back then, we didn't see it that way. I saw myself as maybe part of the popular kids, but I'm not sure that I really belonged in that group. I think that I wanted to be in that group,
right,
and to some degree was, but I also isolated myself from other kids by making the big mistake of wielding what I thought was my intelligence over them. And so I got...
That sounds familiar.
I got isolated because of that, and of course I wasn't nearly as intelligent as I thought I was.
Right, yeah.
Well, yeah.
There's actually a funny story that my dad told me when I was younger that I always find really interesting to look back on and kind of think about. You finished, what, second or third in your class, right? You said? Somewhere in the...
Well, I wasn't the top two. I think I was actually... I actually finished fifth.
So, I remember you telling me back then that you didn't want to finish first. So, you actually made attempts to make sure that you didn't finish first.
It wasn't quite as directed as your words might make it sound. But I was aware that I wasn't first. Mm. And I was aware that I did not want to be first. And mainly the reason I didn't want to be first was I didn't want to give the freaking speech. I did not want to stand in front of people and tell them what I thought about the world, because even though I would wield my so-called intelligence with a sledgehammer's touch often, putting my own opinions and my own persona and my own image of my own intelligence out there for public scrutiny was not something I wanted to really do. So, you know, when I thought, yeah, I could maybe get an A in this class when I was going to get a B, it wasn't very important to me, because it wasn't very important for me to finish first or second.
I always found that was kind of a crazy idea in my brain, because I was like, smart enough to know that I could do it, but also intelligent enough to know that I don't want to do it. Like, it's like dolphins throwing their intelligence tests to make people think they're not as smart as they are.
Well, they are.
That's the thing, is they, like, there's the research on it that actually shows that they've thrown tests.
The dolphins are just evolved gray aliens that are among us. I have literature.
We didn't have any in our school.
The fish.
There were no books back then. Just tablets.
I just think it's like, I'm really intelligent. Do you want to prove it? No.
Then I gotta do things.
Then it's scrutiny. It's, you know, then there's somebody to tell me that I'm wrong. And
I say, just take me at my word.
Yeah.
And move on with it. But
comic books, like, I guess that's back in the day. When you can still find comic books on spinner racks and stuff like that, like in the drugstore and at the grocery store.
Still find them. That's the only place you found them.
Yeah.
Right? There were no...
Direct
there was
marketing.
No internet. I don't know. There probably was direct marketing. You could probably mail order them and have them sent
probably.
To you. But, yeah, comic books existed in drugstores.
And those were for kids.
They were for kids. Yeah, the ones I knew about were for kids. Well, it depends on when you're talking about.
Yeah.
When I was in high school and earlier, when I read Archie, it was, you know, kid stuff.
Right.
And then later, it became less kid stuff. It became the classic definition of adult.
1986, to be exact. That's right.
Well, Dad, you talked to me about, there was a specific company that you really liked.
well, a specific group comics called Zap Comics.
Oh, Zaps. Yep. Yeah, we know.
And Zap Comics originated, I believe, in the 60s. And I was an avid reader of Zap Comics by once I became a freshman in college in 1970. So we would read Zap Comics avidly.
That's pretty cool, actually.
My dad is, in fact, kind of a comic book nerd.
Yeah, yeah.
But
an expired yeah. comic book. Elapsed.
So, like, get into the Zap Comics thing a little bit. Like, a lot of people probably don't know. Like, first of all, they're crazy hard to find. I remember, actually, for 3 or 4 conventions in a row, I tried to find my dad classic Zap Comics so I could buy them for him and give them to him as kind of like a nice little surprise and gift. And eventually I just called him and I was like, yo, dude, they're just not here. Like, I just can't find them. Like, I've been looking for them for, like, 2 years now, and nobody's got that shit, so I just can't.
Anybody who has them is not getting rid of them.
No, they're worth a ton of money because they don't exist anymore. But kind of get into some of the content and characters and stuff you remember from back then.
Well, of course, Zap Comics was the classic definition of an underground comic. It was meant to resist the mainstream society and resist it on all levels. So most people saw it as pornography. And you know, and as an 18-year-old boy, that's one of the reasons that, of course, I was attracted to it. But it was also highly political. And not political in maybe in the sense that a lot of people would think that it was, you know, an extremely liberal version of politics that was bucking up against a more moderate system, because not all the comic book writers were really all that liberal in some ways. So the central author of all these was a fellow named R. Crumb, Robert Crumb.
I love
R. Crumb. Is fantastic.
And Crumb was a real genius. He's considered by some people to be one of the most influential artists of our time. And then there were others, Gilbert Shelton, and I'm not sure I'm going to remember all their names. I suppose the most famous character in R. Crumb's comics, or at least the most famous character that has lasted through time, is probably Mr. Natural. And everybody has seen a picture of Mr. Natural somewhere.
We will post a picture of Mr. Natural on the show notes.
Mr. Natural could be found, I believe, on the cover of, what's the name of Janis Joplin's first album? Not the first album. Anyway,
on one of her albums.
Perhaps I'll remember the name of it. But
remember it on the way home.
text me about it.
R. Crumb did the cover, and it's a bunch of Zap comic-like characters, and I think that Mr. Natural shows up on that. I think Mr. Natural shows up with Grateful Dead art also. So, you know, Mr. Natural was this, like, very wise guru sort of person who, in a way, you know, looked sort of like a dumpy Gandalf. But
he was very wizardy.
Yeah, very wizardy. But he was very much a person of his time also. So he wasn't always as airy as a lot of characters like him would be. He could be quite base and quite gross and get involved in some of these pornographic situations. Another character who was only in Zap Comics a little bit but ended up in the movies was Fritz the Cat.
Yeah. They made two Fritz the Cat movies.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fritz the Cat. And, you know, part of Crumb's appeal, in a way, was that he not only challenged things like you know, social structural lines that were being contested at the time. And sometimes he challenged them, but sometimes he appeared to uphold them. So it would be hard to interpret R. Crumb as being completely anti-racist. Some of his comics could certainly be read as racist. They could certainly be read as anti-racist. Feminist.
What do you think it lends itself to moral relativism in some ways?
I don't know what he would say about that.
Just from your interpretation, from what you...
Well, I think that almost everything that we write about morality is an expression of moral relativism, even those of us who, not me, I don't include myself as a moral universalist. But even the universalists are really speaking a relative position.
Right,
So, it would. It would definitely do that. And I think that sometimes where he appears to step over the line, he's really showing that the line is absurd and ridiculous.
It's like a form of satire.
Yeah, and of course satire always carries with it the possibility that some people won't recognize it as satire.
Right, and take it seriously.
Right.
That's like when people post Onion articles as truth, and you're just like, oh, you're proving the point.
Yeah.
Well, it's like, I actually, for the end of my semester last year, we had a project in my rhetoric class where we had to choose, like, a piece of literature we wanted to talk about the rhetoric in, and satire is my favorite kind of literature. I think it's, like, the greatest form of literature. And I chose A Modest Proposal by Swift, and I remember that particular essay being read by one of my classmates years ago, and them taking it literally. Like, them really thinking that, like, this guy was proposing people eat babies.
Yeah.
And, like, he was like, dude, this is disgusting and awful. And I was like, this is satire, you idiot. Like, this is a giant joke. How do you not see that? And I think that that's very important to think about when you're talking about things like the, like, political nature and whatnot of things like Zap Comics. Like, satire is very important to be able to see as satire.
And to some extent, even when satire is taken in seriousness, it's still almost even more so sometimes plays to its point. Because if someone is disgusted by the thought that someone could legitimately say we should eat babies, then that's proving that, like, okay, even if they don't always connect the dots, you know.
It's a good way to say, well, if you think that's disgusting, then how is what we're doing to the Irish right?
Yeah.
Right.
You know, so.
Which is a great point. So, more about the nerd culture thing on your end. I remember... actually, this is just kind of an interesting story I remember about you and people that I considered to be what is essentially the beginning of hackers.
Freakers. Phone freakers.
My dad actually knew some of the guys.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, in college that hacked into Mavel.
Yeah?
And I walked into my parents' restroom one day when I was at their house, and I saw a book sitting on the sink that was about the kids that hacked into Mabel, and I was like, Dad, are your friends in here? And he goes, I don't think that's specifically about my friends, but yes, like, this is, since hacker culture is very much a part of nerd culture, that would be an awesome place to kind of get your take on how all that went for you. So, if you want to get into without getting the FBI to come arrest
you. Right.
Statute of limitations is over on phone freaking.
Oh, yeah, like 40 years ago. We're going to come get you and put you in Guantanamo.
Here's a quarter, man. Put it in the payphone.
Before I get into that, let me ask you, if you happen to borrow that book because it mysteriously disappeared while I was in the call.
This is now on record.
He's asked me this before, and I'm not going to take a book out of the bathroom. I'm going to leave it there so when I'm doing my business, I have something to read.
Alex, this will hold up in a court of law.
I am aware. And you can polygraph me. I don't know where the fuck that book is. So no, I did not steal a book from my dad.
I don't know why you're looking me in the eye. He's the one you got to tell.
I suppose this was probably my my only real occupation of a place in nerd culture, so to speak. Although, again, we didn't really define it that way. But, you know, I had friends in college, and I went to a very, very technical college at the time. It was Case Institute of Technology, which later became part of Case Western Reserve. And, you know, there are a lot of very brilliant people who could do all kinds of things with phones and TVs that I had never seen before. Just to put this in context, I was there when the first video game came out. I played Pong in bars. Do y'all know Pong?
Oh, yeah.
Pong is no, Dad, please tell me what that name is.
Well, you know, well, you know, to us, this was like something that was just amazing that this could be done. Not only could it be done, but one of my friends, who will remain nameless, could make that happen on our TVs in our dorm.
That's awesome.
He had been
that's so cool.
Respect.
That is so cool.
That's so cool. Like,
not only that, but then he took the TV from there and he bought an oscilloscope, and we could turn our music into video, you know, waveforms.
Yeah.
It was just an amazing time for me. And then they could also he was the main person, but he and with some help also could do really amazing things with telephones.
Yeah.
And he was certainly the intellectual mastermind of all that came after. But, you know, we had the ability to make free telephone calls to any place in the world.
I'm calling Taiwan. Why?
Why not?
Why not?
Because I can. And why wouldn't I?
And I think, yeah. I guess that's kind of the impetus for stuff like that. It was never malicious. It was probably just, was it kind of a, well, I can do this, so why not experiment with it?
It was mostly for fun. But,
yeah.
You know, there was also the idea that, yeah, we could needle Ma Bell. But, you know, in our minds, we weren't really stealing anything from Ma Bell, because these, you know, these phone calls were being made over free trunk lines. The phone calls would not have been made
otherwise.
Yeah. It's not like we were making phone calls that we would have made and paid for.
Right.
So, you know, to us, it seemed pretty innocent. And it turns out that the law regarding all this was very unformed at the time.
And it still is for that.
It absolutely is.
This is like the impetus for a whole lot of this bandwidth.
And because, yeah, I mean
shit
that's,
that we're dealing with these days.
That not only is Phone Freaking sort of the beginning, because you have a lot of guys like Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak started as Phone Freaks. That's how they learned about network structure that they translated into. Honestly, a lot of that culture is part of why the internet became what it was. Those guys weren't classically trained. Those were guys that were hackers and played around with stuff. And even moving up through Napster,
yeah.
And the idea that, like, just like you said, like, I'm not stealing anything because this is music I wouldn't listen to otherwise.
Yeah.
And if I like
yeah.
it, I'm going to buy it.
Of course,
know?
That, you know, that's one side of the view.
Yeah.
And the other
yeah.
side is that, well,
the
nonetheless,
property,
you are
right.
still
right.
using it. And
yeah.
And whether I agree with that or not, I understand what that
yeah.
side is. So we were the beneficiaries of his technological wizardry, and he started making these things called blue boxes.
Yeah.
Yeah, he made them himself
the
in his dorm room.
Blue box.
And we started out with big ones, like a blue box in a paint can, and eventually they got to the size of a cigarette pack. The one that I was personally endowed with was the one in the paint can. That looked like
carrying a paint can up to a payphone.
Well,
like,
and you know, of course, the paint can was like a used paint can, so there was paint dripping down the side that was dried on it, so it looked pretty, you know, it looked pretty well concealed. Except, of course, on the lid there were knobs and dials.
Weird kid Steve with paint can.
Has anybody ever noticed that Fulmer kid carries that can of paint everywhere?
I just love the idea that somebody's walking by and he's just standing in a phone booth holding the paint can
well,
up to the receiver.
well, of course, I didn't actually do it that way. I did it from the phone in my
right.
apartment.
Yeah.
You know, so the paint can would just sit there in the closet, and I'd pull it out, and I'd make phone calls. I had a girlfriend at the time, and she was who I called most of the time. And it turned out that a line that I said to her was what got us into trouble. When I said to her one time, "This is for free," and we were being tapped. And so we got we had a great deal of surveillance on us after that. Now, whether
you're a badass, Steve.
Awesome.
Dude, my dad has a really, really cool younger.
For anybody that
views.
Doesn't know, the way that the blue boxes worked is they would simulate the touch tones from the telephone, right?
Right.
That, yeah.
What happens is that there's a in the book that Alex mentioned, all this is spelled out in detail. It tells you what the frequencies are and all that. But the idea was that you would dial an 800 number, so you get onto a free trunk, and before the number would pick up, you would press a tone that interrupted it. And then after that, then you would emulate the touch tone on the phone. And each number had a designated bitone to it. So there were two tones you were playing at the same time. Mm-hmm. And then it would just call whoever you wanted to.
And the really cool thing is the guy who started all this was a guy whose name was Cap'n Crunch. Because he started phone freaking by using a whistle that he got in a Cap'n Crunch box. And that's where all this started.
He was actually predated by a couple of people.
Oh, really?
They were doing similar things. And I don't remember. Yeah. It's all laid out in the book. But he was one of the very, very early ones. There was a blind guy who could whistle at all.
Okay, wow.
Holy hell.
He wasn't the first one either. This goes all the way back to like the 40s.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
The only thing that the movie Hackers got right was that part where the dude takes the dials 800 number and puts the tape recorder up and freaks the phone. That's the only thing that movie got right. Hacking.
Except for you couldn't still do that in the 80s.
I think it's early 90s.
I think it's 92. Really cool, like, that. And I'm sure it doesn't feel like this for you, Dad, but, like, the fact that, like, my dad is kind of a part of, like, some really weird, cool part of history.
I need whiskey.
I'm going to get my dad some.
If we're going to get into this, I need whiskey.
Yeah, it seems really cool to me. And like I said, like, I don't know, like, because for him, that was just part of his life. Like, for my dad, it was just part of his life. That, like, oh, yeah, my friends and I got free phone calls, and then the FBI came to our campus. And when he told me that, the first time I heard it in this nonchalant, who gives a shit manner. And then I was like, Dad, the feds were outside. Like, and you guys were just like, fuck them. Like, whatever. Like, it's fine.
You guys were, like, the impetus for white hat.
I don't remember if all the details that I'm about to say were true. Because, you know, your memory really floats around after, this is many decades now. This is 45 years ago that all this started, and it all ended about 42 years ago for us. But my memory tells me that that either the FBI or AT&T rented the apartment directly above us so they could surveil us.
God bless.
Wow.
and we were... We do know that we were followed. One of our friends, who I will call J Squared, came into our apartment one time and said, I swear I'm being followed. And we said, oh,
no,
bullshit,
yeah.
No way you're being followed. What are you talking about? And he said, yeah, you know, I walk by a phone booth and a guy will walk out of the phone booth and walk behind me.
It's like something out of a bad movie. Awesome.
Clark Kent is on your trail.
Like there was this part of this thing that the FBI and the CIA have admitted to doing called gang stalking, which is basically different people will stalk somebody to the point that it drives them to make them so paranoid that nobody will believe them, but they are being stalked.
Yeah.
That's kind of cool, actually.
Yeah, there's a good episode of Last Podcast on the Left about. I've been getting way too into conspiracies recently.
Good.
No,
and well, you can imagine I thought about conspiracies.
Oh yes.
No shit. At that point in time, I feel like you had no choice.
I was like, they came to me with an ultimatum: either join MK Ultra or blah blah blah. And that's why we moved to Winston-Salem.
Son, I told you it was because I found a new job. It was really because I didn't want to get, like, cornered into working for the Fed.
This isn't even my real name.
30 tabs of acid and lie detector marks that'll never come off my hands later. We're here.
I'm a sleeper agent.
They called and hit my activation code the other day. I gotta go kill some people in the backyard. And
I like the idea that you're a sleeper agent, but when you get triggered, you're just still aware of it.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, I don't know.
Son, I'll be back in 36 hours. Don't tell your mom.
We were convinced the dude I went to high school with his father worked for the CIA because he was always going to Bogota for one reason or another.
Dude loves Colombia. So
your friend was being followed.
Yeah.
Well, all of us were being followed. We were told that there was a Ma Bell employee posted on a telephone pole outside our apartment and sat up there, I guess, most of the day to see what we were doing. And we got wind of being tailed, and especially, you know, the leader, the intellectual mastermind of all this, we knew that he was in trouble, so we started hiding him out in the, you know, laying on the back floor of the other guy's Cadillac and driving him around town from one place to another. I'm sure they must have known every place we were going.
They're just sitting there laughing like, look, they just like, are we just watched this dude lay across the floorboard.
Like, did you not think we watched you get into the goddamn car?
Well, and did they not know that you know, one of us owned this 63 Coupe de Ville? You know, because he'd owned it for like, since he was like 16.
These kids just start hijacking cars. But no, it just kind of did dawn on me, like, kind of a badass dad, like a little bit of an awesome badass.
Pretty
kind of
subversive.
I was, you know, I was really more towards the periphery. I was there a lot. I was an observer almost all the time.
You were making hacked phone calls.
And I was making calls, but I wasn't somebody who was able to make it happen.
Right.
Right.
Sorry. my bad. I got the hiccups.
How did it all fall apart? What was the...
You know, I was trying to think about that as we've been talking, and I was thinking about that not too long ago. And, well, I don't have all these details quite right, because there was another element of this that was getting John into trouble. But anyway, he eventually got... he got squeezed a little bit by Ma Bell mainly, and then they tried to turn him into an employee, right?
Yeah,
that's what they do.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and then he ended up working for a defense contractor because, you know, knew more than 99% of everybody else.
Yeah.
He knew how to do this stuff. So we all came out of it, you know, without a record or without ever being arrested.
Yeah.
And I, you know, and part of that, of course, was because the law was so out of sync with the whole practice.
And when you're looking at kids, it's like, this is a felony that they can be in jail for a long time for, or like, we can just kind of pretend this didn't happen because they're
trying. Because nobody got hurt. Because
they're trying to be harmless.
Yeah.
Right. And
now
I'm
you
sure,
guys would be screwed.
Yeah.
And I'm sure when they looked at me, they quickly realized that I wasn't somebody who was making it happen.
You're just friends with
And
them.
I wasn't somebody that they could really use.
Yeah.
Right. I would never be able to go in and like make circuits for missiles or anything like that.
Make it! Oh no!
I got a soldering iron.
I got a soldering. Can you give me a blue box? I'll make a phone call.
I'll call my friend who can come down here and do the work. So
that's what Steve Jobs did when he worked at Atari.
Dad, you could have been the one. You could have invented Apple computers. You fucked up, man.
I think I got as far as I could go.
So to kind of get a little bit further on down the line, like, did you notice, like, kind of towards your, like, 30s and 40s and stuff, watching nerd culture develop more? Do you remember, like, the moments when you started noticing things that
See, like, comic shops started to open up, or anything that...
And subcultures.
Like a collection
and
of people.
No, I would say that what made me... You know, as a young professional, and as a young father of very young kids, you get really wrapped up in your life.
Absolutely.
And you can stay in touch with, you know, current events.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be selective. So at least I think I fell into staying in touch with the current events that I was already comfortable with, familiar with, like national and local politics.
Yeah.
And things like that. And I was not really aware of a nerd culture until my kids sort of turned me on to the idea that it was out there. You know, the stuff that you and more you, but also, you know, stuff that Evan was doing, you know, was starting to seem like, and I wouldn't have defined it as nerd culture. I really wouldn't have talked about nerd culture as a thing until probably 2 or 3 years ago, when it kind of emerged from you, Alex, and your friends.
Yeah.
And I started to see it, and I started to...
And that sort of correlates with the rise of, like, the big blockbuster crossover superhero movies and...
Well, yeah, you know, when I look back on it, I think, well, there was evidence there that maybe I could have pieced together an idea of it, but, you know, from an academic point of view, I was never going to pursue it,
yeah,
so I'd never really kind of thought about it systematically.
Well, you were around for 66 Adam West Batman, though. You were around for that.
Yeah, but that, again, that was not the coalescence of a culture the same way that it is happening now. I mean, in, you know, we would go to school and say, oh, did you see Batman last night?
But that was just
like
a piece
of the cool jocks and the you know, the outcasts and all that. Everybody was watching Batman.
Well, that's because there were four channels.
And it's also because...
No, there were three.
Three.
Fox wasn't around
anymore. Yeah.
And that's also because, no duh, it's Batman. Who doesn't watch Batman?
Yeah,
really. But no, like, I actually had this conversation with a friend of mine the other day. I actually think it might have been Taylor. We were talking about, like, when Olivia and I, like, hung out at work a little bit after work one day, she told me that it's so weird to date Taylor as a nerdy person because Taylor is this really confusing mix of, like, nerdy and super redneck. She was like, yeah, like, he's watching Doctor Who and he loves Stargate, but he wears camo and goes hunting. Like,
yeah,
it's
Reed's joke.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's walking Reed's joke.
Yeah,
yeah.
And it's funny because, like, Taylor and I the other day were talking about this and we were talking about nerd stuff because he's been getting more and more into it. Basically because Olivia and I have just been shoving it in his face.
Same with my fiance.
Yeah.
I mean, she wouldn't like Star Wars and Batman and shit.
I just jam it down his throat. I'm like, you're going to go to this thing and you're going to fucking like it.
We're going to take Taylor to fucking Heroes Con this year.
Oh, yeah. No, he actually really enjoyed going to the Minicon.
Yeah.
He really liked
good.
It. Like, a whole... Yeah. Like, he was like... He started telling me his plan for getting Matari to make him, like, big pictures and all
this shit.
And I was like, yeah, dude. Like, I'm stoked because I get to share this with you. But it was weird because Taylor and I were talking the other day and, like... We were talking about, like, what kind of got us into doing nerdy things a little bit. And I was like, I was a jock kid growing up. And if it weren't for my brother bringing home Magic the Gathering cards, I probably wouldn't be doing this today.
Yeah.
That, like, if it weren't for Magic the Gathering, I don't think that I'd be who I am. Because Magic the Gathering is the reason that I met all of my friends in elementary school. All of them. Every kid I hung out with after second grade.
You played Magic at enrichment school.
Yeah.
That summer. Like,
well, here's the thing, though, is that the first dad, you can remember these guys. The first group of friends I had when I moved to the HAG program at Brunson in Winston, Tyler Koff, Whit Ratana, John McCauley, David Harris, like, all these dudes, we met and we hung out because we played the nerdiest goddamn game you could think of at the time, which was Magic the Gathering. And my whole friend group was based off of that card game.
Yeah.
That's all it was based off of. And then we were like, oh, we like video games, and Smash Brothers is cool, we're going to go outside and, like, we're going to shoot darts at each other, and, like, all this kind of, like, real nerdy crap. And it's just so weird, because, like, growing up, you know, doing, like, two-a-day practices 2 times a week, plus a skills training for soccer, plus 2 games a weekend, plus high school games, like, and having... basically my entire world revolve around sports, but still being a drama nerd and playing Magic the Gathering and doing nerd shit.
Yeah.
And it was just this weird dichotomy of, like, being super jockey and super nerdy and how it kind of coalesced into one thing. And it's weird because at the time, it was so polarizing being considered a nerd. And now...
Yeah. It was, like Steve was saying... It wasn't something we ever claimed. It was something that was leveled at you.
But you later claimed it.
Yeah.
Well, of course.
Yeah.
We
never happened for, like, people of my generation. We never claimed that as a culture. Or except for, like, you know, the real old creepy guys that own the comic book stores who's, you know, who make all the mothers of the 14-year-old kids fearful of who they are.
Yeah. And guys who were going to sci-fi cons with 20 other people.
But that was, I mean, they were such a small number of people, at least in my view.
And they
that,
still exist.
Yeah, sure they do. And I don't mean to disparage them. I mean, that's the image that people have of them.
Well, do you remember the guy who ran Paradise?
Yeah.
He was one of those.
Yeah, right.
And
I liked him.
No,
but
Dave was cool.
But I thought,
but it was creepy.
Boy, I'll tell you, the image that other people must have of this guy.
Yeah.
I mean, they probably think, you know, that he's a sex offender or something.
No, he was a perfectly normal guy. He had a girlfriend, and they ended up selling the store because they moved, like, to go somewhere else. But, like, the dude did live in his parents' basement, but he owned his own business, and he made a killing.
Yeah, because he made a killing off all the magic and his workshop.
Yes.
Like, and I went in there to buy Vampire the Masquerade supplements and Ten Sided Die.
That was after he left, by the way.
That was after he left?
This was when Paradise was still where the library was in Thruway.
Okay, I'm talking about Paradise when it moved to Country
Club. Yeah, see, he had sold it by that point, because the original location of that was underneath where TJ's Deli used to be in Thruway.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, like where the
because when it was on Cloverdale, when it was on Country Club, it was still in essentially a dungeon.
Yeah,
like, that's why it was weird going in there, because it was like
it was downstairs,
around the back,
Like that's what it was at Thruway too.
Actually,
you
that
the
kind of
case and
that kind of adds to the aura of it.
Oh,
the
absolutely.
Idea that
yes.
it's a dump and it's
yeah.
totally not totally disorganized, but to the person who first walks in, it looks to be completely disorganized.
It's like a dive bar.
Like, and how
if you walk in, you'd be like, "This is a hoarder's place. This is what this is."
And
for.
Not just that, but like, no storefront place is gonna want that as a marquee. No, like no owner of realty, like or real estate at like a strip mall is gonna want that guy's marquee up as you know one
next
of the storefronts next to Food Lion.
Not anymore.
And well, like. I can't imagine how hard it was for us to find that place before the internet.
Oh, my God.
It was like, all word of mouth. There's a lot of word of mouth.
Yeah, like, I don't understand how we knew that place existed as kids.
You'd have to ask Evan, I'm sure.
Yeah, like, I don't
because
even
he knew.
Yeah, like, I had no idea until Evan was like, oh, go down Paradise Games. And like,
which is, honestly, I think that's part of what's so cool about nerd culture is even as big as cons are and things like that, like,
they're still underground.
If you don't know about Heroes Con, you don't know about Heroes Con.
Yeah.
And like, yeah, you can look it up online, but you don't even know to, right? Yeah. If you're somebody, you can read comic books, you can go to shops, you can be a pretty avid comic book fan and entrenched in the culture and still not know about these things happening.
And Heroes
Con. Or even
like,
know that cons are accessible that way.
Yeah.
Like, people are like, you go to comic book conventions? Like, what's that about? I'm like, anyone can go.
Yeah.
It's not an invitation thing. Like,
and
I
it's,
think people,
and it, not everything is San Diego Comic Con.
Right.
And I think it's very odd to think about the fact that, like, Heroes Con is a massive convention when you're talking about comic book convention. It's really, I think it's one of the biggest in the nation, isn't it? Like,
purely comic book.
Yeah.
Like, no, there are no publishers. There are no, like, Diamond isn't represented there very much.
Yeah.
It's the very
light touch on video games and things like that.
It's one of the only two conventions in the country that's left that's not run by a corporation that's
yeah,
that
Sheldon,
size.
Sheldon still runs it,
and the other convention is up north somewhere. I can't remember where, but they're the only two that get that kind of foot traffic that aren't run by, like, Diamond or publisher.
And
or,
who don't bring in TV people either. Like, you can't go there and meet, like, David Tennant.
Yeah.
Because that's not what Sheldon's about. He never has been.
He's
like,
been
about
the artists and the people selling books.
Yeah, that's what it's about.
But, no, it's funny to, like, think about how difficult it would be, even at something on the scale of Heroes, because it's you're talking about, like, foot traffic of something like, what, 10,000 people last year or something like that over the course of the weekend? 10,000 people or more go see this convention, and still, unless you know about it, you don't know about it.
Yeah.
Like, unless somebody tells, because I didn't know Heroes Con existed until my friend Tony was like, yo, dude, do you want to go to Heroes Con? I was like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And, like, if people don't know they exist, like, you can't just stumble upon it. Like, oh, look, like, in Charlotte next weekend, there's going to be this huge thing. Like, that doesn't happen.
Well, I mean, think about the amount of people in the Triad and in Charlotte. Just the amount of nerds in that area.
We are a
10,000 is still a fairly small percentage.
Yeah.
So it's because nobody knows about it, so.
And I've, like, kind of getting back to the whole, like, nerd culture thing. One of the big things we talk about with nerd culture is Star Wars. And it's because it's so important to nerd culture because of the fan base that it has, and because really nerd culture probably wouldn't have gotten nearly as popular if it weren't for the fact that Star Wars is essentially the largest franchise for movies in history. Mm-hmm. And you were there for the originals. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of something that, like, what was it like for you being at the Star Wars premieres of the original three movies? The Star War. Want to talk about that Star War?
Celestial struggle.
I think that for...
Outer space battle.
For me, you know, I think of Star Wars not necessarily as like the beginning of something, but a very important landmark in something that had already been going on, which really, to me, is the kind of the pushing forward of really well done technical based special effects. Right? To me, that's what it seems like Star Wars is mainly about, that. Because you can tell that story in any way you want, but you can't do it. It can't be Star Wars unless you've got R2-D2 and you've got the fighters going in and out. And that sense of realism that comes with it, that idea that these guys come closer to making it look real than other movie producers do. And so, you know, I remember being particularly impressed with the first Star Wars. I walked out of there thinking, wow, you know, this was quite an experience, because the technical aspects of it were so impressive. And I think that, you know, that when the second and third movies came out, by then you'd already kind of seen it, right? And so you were hoping to see something better than it.
To get that same experience again.
And it wasn't really better in that regard. Like for me, you know, things like the... those little guys, the little furry guys.
The Ewoks.
The Ewoks, I felt, were, in a way, for me, a little bit of a distraction because they didn't convince me. But what did convince me was their village.
Yeah.
I thought their village, man, this village is, like, wonderful.
Yeah.
And I thought, that is you know, that is such a cool depiction that makes it look real, that comes out of somebody else's imagination, and is done, you know, in a lot of intricacy with a lot of detail. So it was really put forth as something that I could really say, man, I can almost see myself being there, but I can't see myself being with these Ewoks.
Well, although, the Ewoks were there to sell toys.
Yeah. Do you know about that?
I'm sure.
Originally supposed to be Wookiees, so it was just supposed to be a shit ton of Chewbaccas.
Around. I didn't know that.
But Lucas had to think about what a lot of his revenue was coming from toy sales. So he was like, tiny Wookiees that are cute. Ewoks. Like, let's do it.
They're also carnivorous.
Yeah.
And vicious.
Yeah.
Vicious teddy bears and spears.
Oh, they're assholes.
Yeah.
But one of the other things about the Ewok part that I thought was very effective were the chase scenes through the forest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They were very compelling. You know, very, you would flinch at certain moments because it seemed like you were going to crash into a tree or something. And to me, you know, that's what grabbed me. I guess that each of us intersects with something like nerd culture in our own way. And for me, it's really, can they make me feel like it's real?
Yeah.
So I thought those two did it really well. And the last story, you know, by then, I guess...
That is the last story.
The Ewok?
Ewok Village is the final. No, two is Empire Strikes Back, which is when Luke loses his hand.
Okay, well, anyway, I've got it mixed up a little bit. It's been a long time. I haven't seen them. But what I also liked about that one then was that, you know, good prevailed again.
And,
you know, that was a good thing, to see good prevail. But, you know, taking that, those three movies, but in particular Star Wars 1, I mean, the very first one, you know, when you think about it, you know, I had seen a lot of movies by then. And even those opening credits where, you know, you are looking at the universe and they are, you know, they are giving you the, you know, the prologue, mm-hmm. all typed out, and it's disappearing into the distance.
And then you see what appears to be a big spaceship being chased by a much, much, much larger spaceship, and that's just the first thing you see.
But you know, but for me, it succeeded some other things that really were personally to me were at least as important. So, you know, going back to when I was a young kid, how old were you guys when Star Wars came out? Or were you even born?
No.
My first Star Wars was in 79.
Oh, okay.
77 for Star Wars.
Yeah, okay. 77, 79.
80 for Empire.
Oh. All right, so you don't know anything about the impact then, because you couldn't
have lived alive.
All we know is from reading. You know.
Yeah.
But for me, it wasn't. It also wasn't like being a fifth grader, mm-hmm. right? Because I had seen a lot of stuff that had come prior to that. So if you want to understand how it struck me, you also have to go back to how King Kong struck me, to how Lon Chaney playing the Humpback of Notre Dame struck me. Because those were all technical advances, right? I don't know if you know anything about this, but Lon Chaney wore a 40-pound weight on his back, and he had a rope that tied one shoulder that connected one shoulder to one knee, I think, to keep him humped.
Wow!
And so that was, you know, it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't electronic, but it was still special effects.
Mm-hmm. I remember probably one of the most impactful things that we talked about growing up in terms of movies, which is why this is still one of my favorite movies to this day, but the way that Dad described the way Jason and the Argonauts.
You have to see that movie if you've never seen Jason and the Argonauts.
It's beautiful. Yeah. It's so beautiful.
They had to shoot that frame by frame. They took these clay, and that's how they did the original King Kong, right? They had models, and they would move them slightly and then take another picture, move it slightly and take another picture, and it was so fluid and everything. And you know, all these were done by Ray Harryhausen and his mentor, O'Brien, I want to say, but I forget who did King Kong. But anyway, Harryhausen learned from that. But when you look at Jason and the Argonauts and you think, man, you know, And to me, if you look at that and then I saw the opening to the Five Armies movie yesterday, and I was totally bored with it. I thought,
don't get me started on the Hobbit movies.
But this is just computerized reproduction that does not come off as real to me. But those skeletons climbing up and down that ship, I thought, holy cow! I mean, this is scary.
You should watch the new Star Wars movie.
Have you seen the new Star Wars?
Not yet. I plan to.
They went back to form, and they used as many practical effects as possible.
Yeah,
it's the perfect marriage of practical and CGI.
Sure. Well, and I thought that the Lord of the Rings was too.
I thought there were
very few things.
That's
that
why the Hobbit was so disappointing.
Yeah. Well, and what was more impressive than the way they did Gollum? Gollum was so impressive, I thought. A great marriage of the two technologies.
I thought that, in all honesty, my favorite part of the whole movie in terms of effects was the massive Uruk-hai army of actual people.
Oh.
Because, and most of them, a lot of people don't know this, a lot of them are women.
Oh.
Because the way that the Uruk-hai are built with that, like, broad chest, they actually used, like, boobs as a way to like actually like compound the armor into looking huge.
Granted, there was a lot of like digital replacement, but only in that.
But they
would just scan. There were actual actors.
Yeah,
and it was just they were just placed throughout.
Yeah,
you know.
But like it was like a lot of those scenes where it's just one platoon. That's a legit platoon of human beings.
Well, like I said, that's why The Hobbit is so disappointing.
Because it's all CG and garbage.
We know, Peter, you can make a good movie with blending of practical and CGIs, so why did you fuck this one up? And why did you take a 130-page book and make it into three movies? But that's a whole other...
Right.
Why did you add something at the end of the movie that we had no idea what the hell it was?
Yeah.
Like, what is...
Well, I didn't watch the whole thing.
You don't want
it
to.
It bored me within a minute.
I still haven't seen the last movie. Cause
it's
first
not worth
two,
it.
I was just like,
there's only like one really cool part of it, and that's
about
it.
My favorite books,
yeah.
And it's sad.
Well, remember, you know, for me, when The Lord of the Rings came out, what year was that?
That was early 2000s.
Early 2000s, right. I read that book when I was 14. And I waited, what? I waited like 40 years
for this book to come. How old are you, Steve?
I'm 63.
Okay, so you're 10 years older than my dad.
Yeah.
You're about as old as my uncle.
So I waited for 40 years to see this. And, you know, I kept thinking my expectations are going to be so high that this movie will never live up to it, but it did. I thought this movie was
so you
really
were around
good.
Like during the when like the Frodo Lives button was like starting to circulate, like when Lord of the Rings culture, there's this whole cultural phenomenon going around.
Oh,
like,
I wasn't part of that.
Like,
I lived in a little town that was
people had like Frodo Lives button, and Leonard Nimoy released an album.
I know
a song
that.
Called Bilbo Baggins,
yeah,
and then Led Zeppelin, like those,
yeah,
fucking
Led Zeppelin
wrote
were
a bunch of
albums
nerds.
About Lord of the Rings.
Fun fact:
they reference Mordor and Ramble On.
Yeah.
Like,
The little fun fact: one of my tattoo artists, my friend Chris Powers, went to high school with the guys from Gwar. With all of them, and
that's right, he's from Richmond.
He's from Richmond,
yeah.
And like he was like those dudes used to just like they were the same guys back then. They're just super weird, always in their basements playing D&D. Like they'd probably be like really weird about me telling stories about them playing D&D. But like, look at them. Like,
but,
of course,
but that's what it takes to be that person, right?
Yeah.
You have to have a certain bent, and then you have to cultivate it. We all have imaginations,
mm-hmm.
But guys that sit around together and, you know, get engrossed by something like D&D and think of all these alternate universes and different sorts of beings that can occupy them and social structures and all that, they're the ones who are going to make this stuff.
Yeah.
Not the rest of us who you know, go to work. And I mean, it's not that they're not going to work. It's that they're engaging with their imaginations in a totally different way.
They're sharing their imaginations and stuff like that.
That's like a great painter. You know?
Yeah.
It's like Salvador Dali. When you think about it, Salvador Dali's paintings are special effects in some ways.
Yeah.
Another person that I would throw a huge amount of credit to would be Stanley Kubrick.
Absolutely.
Yes.
I mean, Stanley Kubrick,
yes.
I thought, you know, he sort of created the modern sci-fi movie with 2001.
Yeah.
Right? That was such and it's a powerful movie today.
They
yeah,
were trying
it holds
to figure
up
out,
so well.
They were trying to figure out how to do anti-gravity stuff.
You know how they did the jogging around the
Yeah.
Yeah, they had it on a
It was on a gimbal.
Yeah, it was on a gimbal and they just kept moving it and he just kept
And the opening sequence of the pin floating. How they figured out how to do that.
I don't know how they did any of that.
It's less complicated than you think. It was fishing wire. But just the way they were able to do it. Like,
yeah.
I could go on for hours about Kubrick. Like, I really could.
But see, he didn't focus only on the sci-fi. So he wasn't going to take us where
Ridley
Lucas...
Scott, or Ridley Scott would with some of his sci-fi.
Yeah. Although, if Kubrick had decided to do it, we would be way beyond that stuff.
God,
yeah.
If Kubrick had done Alien.
Yeah.
Hey, Alien, I thought, was one of the better done. I thought the whole idea behind what the alien was so terrifying.
Yeah.
I mean, even when you killed the alien, it was going to kill you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a killing machine. That's what it's a biological killing machine.
It's like Predator.
I don't even know.
No, I know. So, like, to kind of get into more common culture stuff, more modern day,
I got a question quick. How would you define what a culture is?
I love this.
You know, I give this lecture probably twice a week,
right.
Every day,
yeah.
Every week of my life. So, what is a culture? I think that, I've moved away from that being really the right way to conceive of it.
Okay.
Because a culture makes it seem like a culture is describable like a bottle of water or a table or something. And a culture is not something that's easily bounded.
Mm.
Which is why I've been thinking as we've talked about how nerd culture is affected by other things. So yeah. A former jock like Alex becomes a nerd because culture is not bounded, right? Because the idea of magic can infiltrate the jock persona.
No, jerk
work.
That jerk
I like
work.
That Freudian slip.
The jerk persona.
My horrible son.
The jock persona, you know, and can turn somebody like, you know, Taylor into a comic convention goer.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, culture is this, is really a fluid, dynamic thing that that comes about by our agreements about how the world operates.
Okay.
And then agreements are mainly tacit agreements and are fed by, you know, thousands and thousands of sources of agreement.
Mm-hmm.
So that we create what seems to us who share a culture a quote-unquote natural way of living that appears to us not to be constructed by each other, but actually is.
Right. Okay. Because that's interesting, because I was thinking about all of the subcultures that you see, and it's interesting that, I mean, nerd culture spans from, you know, the super brutal horror movie guys over to people who collect toys from the 1920s.
To people who do math equations.
Yeah.
Well, we actually, like, the tagline for this particular podcast, because we are very, very much of the idea that it's all inclusive in terms of nerdism, I guess.
Yeah.
Which is,
what's your nerd?
What's your nerd is our tag. And that's because, in our opinion, if you are passionate enough about anything, you're a nerd about it.
Yeah.
Like I told you when I said that my dad does fantasy football. I didn't know this until I asked him about it. But, like, I was like,
I was just gonna be like, "What's your ECL, bro?"
But no, like, and I told him, I was like, because I was talking to him when we first started the podcast about the nerd thing, and I was like, "We have anybody on? Like, in our opinions, like, dudes who do fantasy football, like, that's nerdier than anything I've ever done with comics.
I've never seen people get more stressed out over a lineup.
Not only that, but like the amount of research, the
baseball
amount of like
bean counters.
Yeah, like just so.
Well, if you want to think about true nerds, I mean, probably. One source of nerdism would have been baseball statistics.
Oh, those guys!
There is, according to one statistics book I was reading, there are no better statistics in the world than those kept for baseball.
Think about that.
There's so much attention put into baseball.
I know people calculate
stats.
Certain players' OBPs, like
explain that
On base percentage, like. The amount of times they get, they step up to the plate versus how many times they get on base from that.
You know, the movie Moneyball is about a nerd. It's about a nerd.
Yeah.
It's about a guy.
Sabermetrics.
It's about a guy who decides that the best way to run a baseball team is to do it purely on probability and not on what you perceive the intangible characteristics of the players to be. Don't go with your gut. Go with the statistics.
Yeah.
Which bucked decades of scouting.
He's also the only person who has led 5 different baseball teams to divisional championships.
Billy Bean.
And he's also recently been hired by the Cleveland Browns.
Eat shit, Colin! So excited about this. Oh, Colin's a Pittsburgh fan. I'm from Cleveland. Suck it. All right.
No, I think they have a lot better foundation to say that to us.
Yeah.
We'll say I'm glad the Browns finally woke up and were like, yeah, we're going to get rid of Manziel.
Look, Manziel, I'm totally off topic.
But you brought that shit up, so we're talking about it.
And I, you know, I'm actually, in a sort of a weird way, I'm a Manziel fan. But the reason I am is that Manziel, like so many athletes who become the whipping boys of the press, has become the whipping boy of the press.
He's done it to himself.
I don't know. This is a guy who appears to be psychologically in deep trouble.
He needs
and
help.
I don't know if our best stance towards people like that is to say they've brought it on themselves. I think it's to we should be trying to help them find a way back.
I agree with that in a lot of ways. His parents didn't do him any good by pretty much spoiling him throughout. The culture at Texas A&M didn't do him any good because, you know, they prayed him around to all the different Aggie clubs throughout the country and then bring him back and basically let him get away with murder because he was doing such a good job carrying that football team for so long. And then he won the Heisman, so he was pretty much untouchable. So he never really had any discipline. So, of course, when he gets out into the real world with the drug addiction and alcohol addiction problems that he's had, it all started to pile on top of him, and he crumbled underneath it. And I really hope the kid can go off and get some help and come back in 2 to 3 years and really try to make something of himself.
Yeah, I don't care if he becomes a football player again. I just hope he gets his life back.
Absolutely.
I hope he doesn't continue down the path of self-destruction.
Yeah.
But anyway, to kind of hone it back
in. Sports corner!
Sports corner!
Yeah, I'm a Browns nerd.
I've never heard you talk about sports in that manner. That was impressive.
Yeah, I know my shit.
Colin is a reservoir of knowledge. I like to call him the suppository of knowledge.
Because I will get up in your ass.
Never read Wikipedia solo, your eyes bleed.
I always play the Hitler game. I hit random page until I come across Hitler.
Have you ever done the... It's a really fun game to play. You start with Jesus, and whoever can connect Jesus to Hitler through the fewest Wikipedia articles wins.
That's amazing.
So if you click the first...
How many links?
If you click the first link in every article, you will eventually end up at philosophy every single time.
Yeah, there's a couple others that you're almost inevitably going to go through as well.
Yeah.
Apparently,
I can get to Jesus from Hitler like real fast.
Yeah, well, this was also a game in the early days of Wikipedia before it was.
You go Jesus, Spear of Destiny, Thule Society, Hitler, 4.
That's too long. That's too long already.
So okay, some of the stuff I wanted to talk to you about in terms of like current nerd culture stuff is like. Nerd culture has become so pervasive and whatnot that, like, it no longer has that stigma of
Jesus,
the appearance.
Jesus.
Oh, God. Too soon!
2,000 years
ago. So, anyway. You're not going to stop laughing for, like, 10 minutes. That's okay. Originally, nerd had a look. It had, like, Revenge of the Nerds. Like, that was, like,
right.
Big rim glasses, pocket protector, button-up shirt that doesn't fit right. Like,
kind of the way I dress.
Like, the sock suspenders, like, that crap.
Garters.
Yo, to that point real quick, I am so stoked that everybody's wearing these glasses now.
Yeah. I'm like the last one that's not.
I have them too. They're just at home.
Because these would have got me punched in the face 20 years ago.
Yeah.
First time I wore glasses like that, I was accused of looking like Adamant.
Yeah.
That's not a fucking... That's a good thing. Adamant's awesome.
Not back then it was.
You forget where I come from,
sir.
Don't know
if you want to look like Adamant.
It looks like that little red guy.
Are we talking about the cartoon character or the 80s pop star?
The cartoon.
Oh, the cartoon.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I'm talking about Adamant, like the British pop star.
Not that.
So, like, nowadays, like, nerd doesn't really have that much of a look anymore. Like, for example, Chris is very much, like, punky looking and, like, no visible tattoos, dyes his hair every once in a while. And then standing next to Colin or I, like,
or me,
or Dad.
This has been unnoted.
Yeah, that's sorry.
This has been a noted.
You and John would kill each other.
Well, this has been noted to be very characteristic of nerds, is what's called hypercorrection. But go ahead.
Yeah. Well, anyway, we talked about this. Yeah.
As we push our glasses.
But like, we're standing next to someone like the two of us, like Colin or me. Like, we both have a lot of tattoos. I'm like beardy and lots of piercings, and Colin is kind of like thin and Rayleigh. And
oh, yeah, thin.
Or
was.
You're skinny fat. Shut up.
Yeah.
damn, Chris got fat. So we, like, and it's funny because, like, Nerd doesn't have a look anymore. And people...
I'm not sure it ever really did.
Well, oh, yes, it did. It did. It had Revenge of the Nerds was Nerds.
Yeah, but I think that's a...
Stereotypical, but still.
It's a caricature of what a nerd is. Like, I'm not sure that, like... I don't think you really saw... Yes, you know, nerds have tape on their glasses because your glasses break and people end up with tape on their glasses. But I don't think... Yeah. But I don't think there was ever really, like... You could just call it, like... That guy is clearly slightly more intelligent than the rest of the population, reads comic books, and loves Star Wars because he looks like that.
No.
Oh,
but
that,
like,
dude looks like a nerd. Yeah,
but like, looking like a nerd, I mean, the word nerd has changed as well, yes, but like...
That's our word.
You'll use that word. But no, like, it's the word has changed, but also the look behind the word has changed. And like, there was a point in time where, like, when I first started getting tattooed and stuff, when I told people that I was interested in, like, Star Wars and comics, they were like, really? Like, even with, like, the big, like, hard-ass exterior tattoo thing and, like, the giant grizzly beard and all that, like, are you sure that you like that stuff? I'm like, no, I'm just making this up. Now, so, like, it's changed in terms of its appearance, and, like, not only that, but, like, people get excited about talking to you about nerd things now that you otherwise would have had to pull teeth to get to talk to you about. Like, at work, all the good old boys that I work with that are, like, super southern, like, redneck kind of guys, they come up and they just talk to me about, like, man, that new Superman Batman movie looks badass. And I'm like, yeah, it does. You want to talk about it? And they're like,
yeah,
Superman would win. And I'm like, you're an idiot, shut up.
Sit down and let me tell you why you're wrong.
Yeah.
But I think part of the reason that's important, though, is because we're starting to see nerd culture gets so big that it is starting to, instead of being influenced by pop culture, it's starting to influence pop culture. And so you have those people that are just very servicey, just lightly contacting it through pop culture, that then you're their outlet
to talk
about it, you know?
Yeah.
Well, out of curiosity, Dad, like, through the years of watching kind of nerd culture develop and stuff, did you ever think about that when you were taking us to see, like, the Batman movie for your kids? Like, Batman Begin, or, like, Batman Beyond, and or, like, Forever. Batman Forever, Batman and Robin, like, the Steven, or not the Steven Spielberg, the one with,
Okay.
The Nightmare Before Christmas guy. I can't
Tim
remember.
Burton. Really?
Tim Burton.
Really?
I'm
Tim
sorry.
Burton was Batman 89, Batman Returns. Joel Schumacher
no.
was Batman Forever.
I don't, that's not the point.
It's
shut
still
up.
Still the Tim Burton franchise.
Yeah, it's the Tim Burton franchise.
It's the Warner,
like,
Brothers.
But still, like, when you
can we go back to the question?
Yes.
I have a correction.
Shut up, Dick.
I kind of lost it.
So, like taking us to see things like that, like the movies that now would be considered, like, nerd culture movies, like those Batman movies, and, you know,
mm-hmm.
During the late 90s, early 2000s, they had the, you know, X-Men movies and the other comic book movie. Blade was a comic book movie. Like, going through and seeing all those, did you ever think about, like, that as a, like, oh, this is comic book stuff, this is nerd stuff, or did it just kind of dawn on you later that's how that developed?
That's an interesting question. I think for me, you know, I've always kind of taken movies at face value. You know, a movie is just a movie. I mean, it's, and I don't mean to deprecate movies in that way. For me, the important connections between movies when they were about novels that I had read, not about comic books that I had seen. And I don't know exactly how to describe that difference. But for me, I felt like movies could be freer of the content of the comic book than they were allowed to be, in my mind, of the content of a novel.
Well, that makes sense, because novels, a lot of times, a movie that's based on a novel is meant to illustrate an idea, whereas a movie that's based on a comic book is just an illustration of a character. And so it's a lot more open to interpretation.
Well, I think it's more than that, because when you're talking about a book, an interpretation of a book, you have, you know, between 100 and 300 pages of
right.
a single
it's a
story.
Very specific thing.
Above one writer doing one story one way.
Yeah.
And then you have Batman, which is 40 years at the time of, like, or 40 or 50 years at the time of the first Batman movie coming out, of, like, hundreds of writers and hundreds of artists.
Like, you have to, so instead of saying, like, if Pride and Prejudice came out, it's like, obviously, we know who wrote Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah.
Jane Austen. That is Jane Austen, right?
I've never been asked for a correction on Colin, like, ever. Colin's never asked
I get the Austens, I get Jane Austen and the Bronte sisters.
You better watch out. Are Jane Austen fans?
They can.
Vicious.
I don't give a fuck. Ride. but when you talk about Batman, it's like, oh, is it Grant Morrison Batman? Is it Denny O'Neill Batman?
Yeah.
Is it Frank Miller Batman?
It's Golden Age Batman.
Golden,
is it
Bat
God?
Is it bronze?
Yeah.
So, and also with a novel, I feel like a novel is almost harder because you have less people to please and less people who are going to be very, very angry at you if you get it wrong. But it's kind of left up to your interpretation as a filmmaker and as a designer.
Don't you think that maybe is more true of the comics? Since
you've got so many reference points,
right? So many different authors and ages who have written about the same character.
And not only that, but
you have a guideline as to where to take it.
Well, but that's the thing, is that novels have, like, I would definitely argue that novels have a wider base. Because, like, who the hell has not read The Scarlet Letter? Like, who has not read that
book?
There are
so many movies written
novels
that are obscure.
Well, I know that, but, like, for the most part, you're, like, when you're talking about really wide, like, because most of them, like, of course there are novels that get turned into movies that, like, nobody's ever heard of. It's like, apparently the woman who wrote the book, I Know What You Did Last Summer, she went to see the movie and she was like, this is not the novel I wrote.
Yeah.
And having read the novel?
Yeah, it's not even close.
Absolutely not the novel.
But, I feel
that's kind of the point, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Is that's how people look at the relationship between movies and novels.
Yeah.
Is that the novel that I read?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And when they read comic books and then see movies about the comic books, and you can correct me because I don't know for sure, but it's like that there's this license for, because it's such an evolving paradigm,
mm-hmm.
An evolving artistic thread, that the movie is also allowed a lot more creative license.
Yeah.
Well,
and so it can take it in a different direction. It can interpret the characters in different ways.
I completely agree with that.
I think there's a very important thing to be stated here about that, and that is that when that really started to get more uncomfortable for comic book fans, when it started to get more personal, when it started to get, like, more scrutinized, was when the names of the movies started adopting the names of specific runs of comics.
Oh, sure.
That's when it started to get weird.
Right.
Because if you're talking about, like, oh, X-Men 1 and then X-Men 2 and then X-Men 3,
that's,
they have those subtitles.
Story.
Yeah, it's just like, whatever. It's
loosely
like, it's Wolverine and Pals. Like, whatever, it's fine. But, like, when you start talking about, like, Age of Ultron.
X-Men Apocalypse.
Avengers Civil War.
Yeah, that's true. They may as well be novels.
Yeah, you're talking about things that people have personal connections with.
Sure,
that's true.
And that's different.
You also have a different, I think, take on culture, a different level at which to analyze culture when you look at how the movie then gives the viewers a chance to debate what the central reality of the original comics were, because people will disagree.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
we do
so
all
it gives
the time.
You, it gives you a chance then to kind of hash out in detail your vision of the comic books, what they are, what the important parts are, what they should be. Yeah, I think what they should be is really important. So just to kind of go back to for me, because I haven't been, I've never been a reader of Batman,
mm-hmm.
A little bit of Superman when I was a kid, but, I've never been committed to reading those comics. And so for me, it doesn't matter a lot. What I like is, like, do they do a really great characterization? Like, the Joker.
In The Dark Knight?
Jack Nicholson.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, The Dark Knight, too.
Yeah.
I mean, those so different characterizations of the same character.
Yeah,
but
they're supposed to be.
And
that's
good. And they're so great, both of them.
But when you read, like, a book, how do you make two different characterizations of the same book and make them both equally great in somebody's mind? I think that's a little bit more difficult. So,
right.
So for me, the movie I always think about when I talk about this is the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I thought had some great parts to it, but I had read the book not too long before the movie had come out. So to me, they were pretty proximate in time, so there wasn't a temporal disconnect, but I felt like there were certain things the book didn't do. The movie didn't do, because the book is seen as, like, it's the reality, and the movie is supposed to characterize. It's supposed
reality.
To interpret that reality for you. And the scene that really disappointed me in the movie was, I don't know if
spoilers.
You've ever, if oh, you've ever
shut
seen,
up.
Yeah, here's a spoiler alert. if you've never seen the movie,
for a 40-year-old movie,
watch the scene when McMurphy breaks the window to the nurse's station. In the movie, it feels like a guy broke a window. In the book, this was the pivotal point of the movie.
It was the grand act of defiance.
It was the grand act of defiance. It was him trying to take power from her. Mm. And so it was the moment for me in the book that was the most important thing to get right. And I thought, they didn't get it right.
John actually has, my roommate John has a point to make about the Road. Which is one of his favorite books, and about how there's a scene in The Road in the book where the father and his son are in a really dangerous situation where it's possible that they're about to get captured, and he has to explain to his son, who's very young, how to kill himself so they don't get captured and the kid doesn't get, like, tortured and raped. And in the movie, they take that scene and they put him just out in the middle of nowhere with nothing threatening them. And the guy's just like, oh, that's how you kill yourself. And John was like, why? Why would you do that? Why would you take, like, the best, most, like unbelievably uncomfortable scene in the book that's so impactful and just turn it into a throwaway line about, like, if you need to, just put a fucking gun in your mouth, pull the trigger, you're dead. Like, it's just
stupid. Well, I don't
know.
I don't know what the explanation is. I guess I'm tempted to think that the director kind of misread the book in that case.
Yeah.
Just getting handed a screenplay.
Yeah. I mean, there are some things about One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest that I just loved, but I just thought they just didn't justice to it. And sometimes they do justice to books.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Sometimes the movie is better than the book.
Yeah.
Oh, sure.
Case in point,
Fight Club.
The Shining.
Oh, yeah.
The Shining.
You know, Fight Club.
No,
actually.
I disagree.
I think
Shining wasn't better.
Fight Club.
Ooh, fight.
No.
Fight Club's very interesting because I would make the argument that neither the movie nor the book is better.
They're just way
and
different.
I think that they do a very, very good job of covering the exact same material, but putting it on display in an incredibly different manner.
That's true.
And because the book is very in his head, thinking. It's lots of, it's all internal dialogue that you can't portray in the movie.
Yeah.
And I think they do a very good job in the movie of giving you that sense of that, while also
giving you the exterior.
The awesome visuals and things that you never get from the book.
Yeah.
So I think that's almost counter to what we were saying before about how
where you can actually do two interpretations of the same thing
and have them both
and have them both. Yeah.
And in the book, the narrator is very much the untrustworthy narrator.
Right.
And you never see, for all intents and purposes, let's call the narrator Jack, because that's how he's referenced in the movie.
Yeah.
Jack doesn't do much. Everything is, he's always reacting and dealing with external forces acting against him.
Right.
Whereas in the movie, Jack is very much a willing participant in a lot of things.
And they accomplish the same goal at the end of the book, by in the book, it's a better tactic to have him be very hands off, and you don't really, you don't really trust him. He's untrustworthy, but in the movie, it's the exact opposite tactic of like, this is what's grounded. This is the one thing that you know.
Yeah,
and then we're gonna flip all your expectations upside down, and it's a great way to illustrate.
Yeah,
but Palahniuk also has a very, Palahniuk is very big on the powerless male,
right,
in his books. Like, if you look at books like Choke, the dude is completely powerless against his addiction and his wants nothing more than to be loved by strangers and make a little bit of money on the side, but never gets a real job.
Yeah.
And, you know, in what's Lullaby, he's a private eye who never really solves anything because he's too emotionally distracted by the loss of his wife. Like, so that's just a theme of Polonic's work, whereas a theme of Fincher's work is the darkness that surrounds us and the darkness inside. See, I could...
Yep.
I'll stop. I'm
well,
sorry.
I kind of one of the last things I wanted to kind of ask my dad about. So we've looked at kind of the whole nerd culture thing, and one of the things that we've always picked out on, and this is probably one of the last things we're going to talk about before we wrap it up. When we go to conventions, you notice that like it is a large group of people that are there for the same thing from very different walks of life. They're very different, but they have very common interests in some ways, and like, we've always noticed that, like, you are in a room full of people that are essentially horribly introverted and
yeah.
type B and anxious and just a lot of people with like, mild autism and whatnot that are drawn to these
and
things.
And a lot of people
that,
who are intentionally disconnected
yeah.
that are
and,
going to a social gathering.
And, like, so you're talking about putting hundreds, if not thousands, of people who don't do well with people in the same rooms together. And like
it's funny.
It is. It's like it's weird and it's funny, and you're just like, God, like everyone here is so uncomfortable with the fact that there's so many people around. They don't give a shit. They're here, and like,
and there is a level of comfort,
yeah,
to that. In
yeah,
itself.
But we were like, one of the things that we've talked about with this is like, why do you think that this particular culture kind of appeals to people like that? Like, because you know, a lot of us that are in our friend group, we're very type A nerds. Which is pretty rare. Like, you don't find as many type A nerds as you do, you know, the introverted nerd. We're just not as prevalent as mm-hmm. the latter. But, like, just from your standpoint as, you know, someone who's looked into cultural things like that, like, why do you think that this kind of culture appeals to people who don't really like people?
That's a really interesting question. And so, and what I'm going to say is completely on the fly.
Fine. That's yeah. our shtick, man.
And I would love to go to a convention so I can observe that.
I've invited you like four times. Don't give me this shit, Dad.
Yeah, but I haven't had a really good reason to go until now.
Hey, Dad, your son is running panels at really important conventions. Yeah, that sounds like shit. I'm gonna stay home.
600 people are watching me do this thing, Dad.
Yeah, it's fun. I saw you play soccer. You weren't good at that. You're not very good at this.
But as an anthropologist, the question that you've just asked is a really interesting question, right?
Well, and goddamn, I guess I figured that fucking puzzle out.
If you write a paper and get published, we want footnotes.
Oh yeah,
you get footnotes. You
credit
get credits. So what I am inclined to say at this point is that there's something about the interests of nerds, like the, you know, especially like the gaming mm-hmm. and the comics and the movies and the fantasies. And all that, that I think perhaps help to create a reality that they can engage with without engaging another person.
Mm-hmm. That's,
right?
Yeah.
And
or at least minimal people.
Or minimal people. They
and intentionally selected people.
Yeah, and
if
also,
you walk into a con floor, everybody's together, but
not really.
But you can look at little pockets.
Sure, sure.
Of people.
That would be interesting. But I, you know, I think that part of it is also that it gives them control over a kind of virtual reality that they don't have control of in the parallel real reality.
Right.
So in a, you know, somebody who is, say, slightly autistic sitting around this table feel really withdrawn partially because of how boisterous all of us are.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and they don't have control over that. They can say something like, could you guys be quiet or whatever to try to control it, but how are people like that generally responded to?
Right.
Oh, shut up, you idiot, you
yeah.
know, kind of thing, making them perhaps even more withdrawn. But in a gaming situation, you know, when they're playing some game online, they have a lot of control.
They create the characters. They create how the characters respond to each other. And if they are engaged with other people playing the game and the other people aren't doing what they want, they can turn it off and go start another game somewhere.
Yeah.
Right? You could do that with the movie is a totally passive experience. There's no real engagement of the characters with the person. They might have a harder time with, say, a live play in which the characters go out into the audience.
Right.
That's just a speculation.
Yeah.
But that would be, I think, would be less control. So the idea that it's two-dimensional, the idea that it is distant from them personally, that it is based on characters that they have some control over creating and they have a control over their own response, may help to explain some of that. I mean, these are people who are antisocial, but not totally of their own choice, right?
Right?
I mean, they're moved to the margins of society. Mm-hmm. They're not
become content there. I mean,
well, they have to because they can't be content in society because society is telling them all the time there's something wrong with you.
Well, it's funny because we've actually like several of us have had conversations where we've just kind of determined our levels of our own like kind of semi-autistic behaviors.
Introverted behavior.
Some of it is very much...
I just don't want to...
You don't want to diminish that.
Right,
no.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's like... Because one of my friends actually does have autism, and he was like... And he actually talked to me about this one day, and he was like, some of the stuff that you do feels a whole lot like when I'm having my really, like... episode, like, spells kind of thing. Like, you do stuff that I do when I'm having my, like, really bad, like, autistic behavioral stuff going on. I'm not fully convinced that I don't have some mild version of autism somewhere. There's a very real possibility that that's, like, because of, you know, the way that I react to certain things that just are, they're not really logical to the point of where I feel they're fully within my control. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I feel like a lot of other nerds like me do that as well. But the thing with like having that control over things is very much a part of how I feel about why I love the things that we do in terms of the nerd shit. Like, I was obsessed with a video game for a long time because I got to choose everything in that game that I wanted to do. We got really into the role-playing RPG tabletop stuff because we created the world ourselves, a whole world.
And you were the director a lot of times.
I was
instead of one of the characters.
I was the guy who was controlling gods.
Right. It seems to me perfectly, perfectly in line with what you're saying. Some of the things that I noticed.
Yeah, and it gives you this sense of, like, it's so comforting to be like, well, shit, whatever I want to happen here happens.
Yeah.
My character that I create, that I love, he'll never die. Because I don't care, like, if I'm in control of the whole game, I'm not going to kill him. And these idiots are never going to roll high enough to kill him. Like, because if the maximum is 20 on the die and they need a 68 to hit him, they're fucked. Like, they can't do it.
GM's illusion of control.
Yeah, like, oh, that's cute. You guys want to do this thing? I'll let you think that you're doing it. I think that that's a super, super accurate insight and very good insight in terms of...
And so, I guess the original question, I think, was partly on why are these people then who generally approach situations and prefer to be in situations that are hands-off inclined to participate in large social interactions with each other? And how is that... Do you feel like that would be different for them than it would be to just, like, go out to a bar?
Yeah, I do think it would be different. And I think that's really... In a sense, the question that I was trying to say earlier was so compelling to me. What is it that then gets somebody who feels more or less reclusive to come out? And maybe part of it is, the chance to be around other recluses. Because, I mean, think about the total contradiction of that whole scene for them.
Yeah.
They're so used to being alone, and now they have a chance to interact with other people who are also alone.
Yeah.
All I see is my parents every day, and now I'm going to be around 100,000 people just like me.
Yeah, but I think that there's got to be something compelling about that. And it probably puts them in a really paradoxical moment.
Right.
Because here are all these people, but these are people like me. And the problems in that I encounter so often from day to day is that nobody else is like me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, it's this idea then that they can be attracted to the same spot, and even if they are so socially awkward, because they haven't had the chance really to exercise those social muscles, even if they're so socially awkward, they still get to see, they can identify, these people are like me.
Yeah. And that's interesting, actually. We just took our former producer, Logan, to his first con, one of the after parties was a dance party. And he, didn't want to go. He's like, it's a dance party. I don't want to do that. That sounds really lame. I don't like that environment. I don't like the type of people who do that. And then he got there, and about 20 minutes in, after talking to people, and he got there, and you almost expect a Comic-Con dance party
to
be, a bunch of people just, standing still, up against the wall, right?
No.
But people are going crazy.
We were having a blast.
Yeah. And
well,
Logan
show up in costume and no one knows what your face looks like, you can do whatever fuck you want.
But, so Logan was walked in and was intimidated by this, but after he started talking to people about 20 minutes into it, he was like, this is really fun because these aren't the people that would be doing this at the places that you do that. These are the people
who only do it here.
That only do it here.
Right.
Yeah.
This is not a downtown Greensboro club.
Yeah.
But Alex, your point about the mask is a very important point, right? Masks allow us to to be who we are sometimes reluctant to be.
Yeah.
Like I
can
tell you,
Deadpool dance party. 20 Deadpools in a dance.
20 guys in Deadpool suits in the middle. And I've thought about that
too.
Breakdancing
poorly. But it's awesome.
I thought about putting on because I like to dance. I'm just not good at it. Just really not good at it. Like, and I thought about it. I was like, fuck it, man. I'll just put on a white Jabberwockies mask and just walk downtown one day and just start shitty popping locking. And as long as I wear a long sleeve T-shirt and cover my beard, who's gonna know? Olivia, you got something to say?
This is somebody who doesn't really like large groups of people but loves to go to cons and stuff like that. Oh. Part of it is you still have that control because nobody else there really wants to interact with anybody else.
They don't really want to touch your ass.
So you still, everybody's trying not to touch each other. And
and no one's talking to each other unless you explicitly have a common interest.
Yeah, oh, hey, you're wearing a costume from the show that I'm also wearing a costume from. Let's get a picture together. Cool. We're never going to talk to each other again.
That's
just really nice.
Chris and I at 2014's NC Comic-Con saw maybe the most awkward interaction between two people dressed in costumes from the same TV show, the Naruto kids. Do you remember this?
I know.
One of them was dressed in a costume as a bad guy, and the other one was dressed as the main character. And their friend is taking a picture, and the kid in the bad guy costume, who's just there by himself, is like, I don't know what to do. The guy doesn't really have any powers that I don't have a blade or anything. And the guy behind the camera is like, just put your hand out like this. And then the kid who's dressed as the main character is down in a crouch pose. And one of the kids that's standing by him is are you just going to take the picture of this? And he goes, I'm just going to edit in fireballs and shit. And I was like... All right, and you can tell that the kid, the bad guy costume, was like, I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this at all. I'm just in this costume, and these motherfuckers are making me do stuff. And, it was just this, it was so awkward, because, I was like, dude, you dressed up, and you knew that you were going to end up having at least one person ask for photos or things like that. So you signed up for this, and at the end of the day, you were like, nah.
Well, just remember, cosplay is not consent.
No, it isn't. It is not consent. Yes.
Because Olivia had... one girl came up to Olivia and was like, yeah, I took your picture earlier. And Olivia was like...
Not me, Olivia.
My fiance, Olivia. This is going to get confusing.
Just call her OG.
OG. And Olivia was like...
Oh, I like that for several reasons.
Yeah. And I was like... Olivia was like, okay, that's kind of weird. It's a person that I might be doing work with in the future, so I'm not going to name check her. But I was like, yeah, I was like, don't do that.
Yeah.
ask.
Yeah, no, and like, I understand if you're taking a picture of something else and like,
I happen
homeboy
to
walks
too.
By through yeah. the frame wearing yeah. like wearing the Megatron
yeah.
costume, like, yeah, Megatron's yeah. in the background, like, whatever.
Yeah, that's and there's neat. Times where we're at cons and we're just taking pictures of the floor and stuff.
Yeah, like, if I'm just doing a panoramic and your ass happens to be in my shot, like, please don't cry about it.
Yeah.
Like, I am not specifically singling you yeah. out.
And,
like,
not making
money off
and
it.
If yeah. you see me taking a picture and you ask me to delete it,
I'll then I will. I will delete it if yeah. you're like, I don't really know what... I'll just take a white erase and just...
What really kills me are the kids who are obviously socially awkward. God bless them. So they go so far to the other extreme...
That
of where
too
they're just
it.
They're just socially unaware.
Yeah.
yeah.
Like, maybe running through the main floor of the con hall and screaming for your friends is probably not the best thing to do.
Yeah.
Like, basically everybody I saw dressed up as something from Homestuck.
Oh, dude, Homestuck. I will say this.
I'm not
like,
shitting on a fandom, but
no,
most Homestuck kids are weird.
Well, it's not that they're weird. It's that they are, like, oblivious to the fact that
they're oblivious to go back to the theme of the episode, to the social construct that exists.
It's to me, it's more of the fact that they don't realize that they're getting in the way. They're getting in the way of other people being able to do the things they came and paid money to do. Like the kids who sat out front of Charlotte's the convention in Durham and screamed the Homestuck theme song for 25 minutes, and I was like, do you guys realize that I'm trying to have a conversation right now that's important, and this is the only place I can have it at the moment, and you're just, there's 30 of you screaming a song.
Do they have a Homestuck con? They need, it sounds like
they should have one, but like, I've
have
never
one only one they should go to.
Yeah,
well, I mean, I want to be all-inclusive.
Yeah.
I love everybody.
Yeah, but like,
just don't be a fuck-ass.
Yeah.
You know what ruins things? Fandoms.
No, yeah.
Fandoms ruin things.
Like, I will say this.
I don't watch Doctor Who anymore because of Doctor Who fans.
Yeah, and like, that's one of the things that I've kind of gotten on, like, tirades about is how much certain fandoms of certain things just drive me crazy. And, like, and it's because of, like, how unbelievably weirdly elitist people can get
yeah.
in nerd culture.
Yeah.
And, you know...
The whole gatekeeper thing.
Like,
yeah,
like my nerd is better than your nerd? Like,
yeah. The gatekeeper complex is obnoxious.
Explain the gatekeeper complex.
Gatekeeper complex is like that friend of yours, everybody has one, that somehow thinks because they're into something, you have to... Number one, you're never going to like it as much as they do.
Yeah, they feel like they're the foremost authority.
Number two, if you seek it outside of them, they're probably going to get a little annoyed because they want to be the person
that shows
it to you.
And if you have an independent interpretation of it,
it's probably
wrong.
I call it the nerd spirit guide.
Yeah.
If you want to go on a vision quest for Naruto...
That's cool, man.
Like, and
like, if I say I don't,
and everybody
like,
likes to be that guy.
Yeah.
Everybody wants to be the dude
when,
who got you into
well,
the thing.
And it's I'm in a perfect position where I work because I am the only one that they can go to. I am the only
yeah.
person at
you got,
work.
You got two on your heels.
Well,
she's on a different shift than he does.
She works a different shift, and she's also she, like, if they want to go talk to somebody about Doctor Who, that's her. If they want to talk about comic books, that is me. Like,
yeah,
there's, like, nobody, like...
I'm going to him about comic
yeah,
books right
yeah.
now, because I want to start getting
yeah.
into comic
yeah.
books.
And I got Alex into comic books.
Yes.
Back into comic books.
Yeah. But anyway, like, I want to thank my father for being here.
Yes.
This is
yes.
fantastic.
Thank you so much.
This was, and once again, I would mention to everybody that I'm a super big fan of the fact that we get to do storytelling on here.
Yeah.
In every fed, because that's
yeah.
where we started, that's what we are.
The phone freaking conversation totally blindsided me. That
you
was
didn't
absolutely
know.
Fantastic.
I forgot that, yeah. I forgot that I never told you. I had
am,
told Colin,
I
never told Chris.
I love hacking stuff.
Yeah.
That was
yeah.
A pleasant surprise.
I wanted to bring that up, and I didn't want to tell you so you could pee a little.
yeah.
So, but...
I don't have any picks for this week.
No, I'm good with the way the episode
yeah.
has gone. But everybody, please, send us comments and emails and messages.
Nudes and boobs and penises.
If you guys want...
Do we actually have an email for them to contact us at, right?
Yeah. If okay. If, I don't know what it is. If you absolutely don't have... If you... I believe we still have booking and we also have...
Booking's good.
Booking is good. Yeah, but if you don't want to go through that...
We'll come up with a different email. But if you're an email person, just booking@namerdactpodcast.com if you want to talk to us.
Or Colin.
Or like any of us. Colin, Nielsen. Alex, or Nielsen at Namerdact. Like, if you guys have suggestions about topics you want covered, if you have suggestions about people you want us to talk to, or, like, comics you'd like us to read, movies you'd like us to see and review, anything like that... We are here for you guys. Please, 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 we want to hear from you guys more often. If you're older listeners and you have segments that we used to do that you really like, we're trying to get some input on segments
you
guys like. If
you're one of the growing number of people that wants to hear more about Reggie.
Yeah, if you guys are into a confusing world, if you would, if you would really love us to do a Super Fight spinoff, the more people we get to talk about it, the more likely it's going to be that I'm going to take charge on it.
I'm fairly active on Twitter, independently of the podcast. You can find me at @C_NorrisNR. You can just talk to me on there. I'm fairly open.
I'm at PBPunk on Twitter.
On Instagram, I am at @BASketchbooks. If you want to get at me there. Send us anything on Facebook, email, anything you want. Please, please, please. We would love to hear from you guys. Yes. We're here to do this for you. We cannot stress that enough. But
if this is your first time listening to the podcast, please subscribe.
Like, comment, rate.
Rate, all that good stuff.
Share with your friends and all that. Steve Fulmer, my dad, thank you so much for being here, Dad. This was fantastic. Olivia, fantastic job as the as the first time on.
For now, we'll see.
You're being judged. And if you guys would like a follow-up to this, I know eventually I will we'll get a little bit deeper into this. Maybe Dad will
come
set
to
aside.
A con.
Maybe,
it'd be awesome if he came to a con.
Maybe he'll come to a con
and
maybe he'll set aside like 2 or 3 days, like, every couple months to look into nerd culture a little bit and look into to it a little bit more so we can get a little bit more in depth. But I had a fantastic time tonight. I'm really happy with this. I don't have any picks or plugs. I'm totally stoked about the way things went and I'm good with going out.
Just a couple little things. Next week we have a big interview coming up.
Yes, we do.
Week after that, I don't want to bury the lead on that one. February 28th.
Say who we're interviewing.
Yeah, tell Alex who we're interviewing.
We're interviewing a young man named Rafer, who works for Valiant Comics doing the artwork for Archer and Armstrong. And he also is the artist on a fantastic and hilarious comic strip called Darkseid and Thanos.
Yes.
What is it? Carpool Buddies of Doom.
Yeah.
If you have not seen it, please check it out. It is amazing.
Yeah. Get the job now. Read all that stuff up so you know about it when you hear the next week's podcast.
You can find Archer and Armstrong
online somewhere. We're not going to tell you how.
And you can but you can also go to your local brick and mortar shop and you can buy trades of it.
Just so, yeah.
Just to get
Thanos
familiar.
Thanos
Darkseid is online on Rafer's page for free. We will have links and stuff in here for all these things for you guys to find.
Week after that, we have something very exciting. Spirit System
is
coming in. So all of you goth babies out there
are
really going to enjoy that. We'll probably demo a new... we'll probably play a new song from their album that comes out the next day. It is... Eric and Lori are just great people. They're awesome. Can't wait to have them on. March is going to be essentially...
It's Creators Month. We're very excited.
Month. And it's we got a lot coming up. March 2nd, Chris and I are going to be going down to Charlotte to do something that we'll keep you...
In the loop on.
In the loop on as soon as we get it confirmed. April 16th, we have Oak City Comic Show. We will be there all day. Probably won't have a lot of free time, unfortunately, because we're going to be so busy. But
we always have time to take a picture with
you. And we also always have time to talk to you about stupid shit.
Yeah. But,
even if it's only 10 seconds.
We will be there all day running panels,
yep.
running back and forth. We can't wait to see you there.
Yes. Thank you guys for listening so much.
You got a comedy show coming up, too.
I'm not going to be on the show, but February 28th, 27th? 27th. 28th. Wait.
I don't know.
We'll put it in the show notes.
27th. Is going to be open mic. Not open mic. It's going to be the Not Safe Place Comedy Work...
Not Safe.
It's a comedy showcase.
Not Safe Place Comedy Showcase
okay.
at Cranky's Coffee in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. 10 p.m., $7 gets you the comedy stylings of Zoe Myers, Reed Pegram, Anthony Lowe's going to be hosting. and headlining is Erin Bialis, and she is very, very, very funny.
I'm gonna be there hanging out.
I'm gonna be there hanging
out.
I'll probably be doing sound for it, honestly. Yeah. But yeah, it's gonna be great. And DC Metric.
Yeah. I'm not gonna remember it. That's stupid. That's a stupid monogram, whatever. Fucking anyway. So thank you, Steve Fulmer.
I still can't do it.
Oh my god. Thank you, really? Steve, my father, for coming out and being on the podcast. Olivia, thank you for sitting in with us today. As always, I am Alexander Fulmer.
I'm Chris Nielsen.
I'm Colin Norris. Go out and touch the butts.